Amen. Thank you so much. Today, you know, our intern is Manuel Nzambi, and some of you might not know him. He's from Angola. He's 66 years old. And today we're in a time that we prepare sermons and so together. And as we were sitting there, he says, I just have something to say. Because we were going through the book of Exodus and Pharaoh was king and whatever. He says, you know, I really miss having a king. See, when I was a kid growing up in Angola, we had a king. I got to see him once. I don't like democracy, he said. He said, it's so nice having a king. For us Americans, it was like, that can't be true. Kings are bad, you know. Kings are dictators, you know. We just have been bred so long that democracy is the best way. He said, when they brought in democracy, that's when our country fell apart. And that's when everything collapsed. But as long as we had a king, life was good. He took care of us. He watched over us. The best form of government is a king. Now, you and I just like, can't be. But think about it. What is the best form of government?
Kingdom rule.
Kingdom rule, as long as I'm the king. All right? I remember my teacher saying that in eighth grade history. The best form of government is dictatorship as long as I'm the dictator. All right? Now, the best form of government would be a king as long as you had what? The greatest king. If you had a good king, a wise king, a caring king, compassionate king, whatever, you don't have elections. You don't have all this stuff. If you had a great king, it would be fine. In fact, when we get to the millennial kingdom, what kind of government are we going to have? Elections every 4 years, or, you know, we're going to have the best form of government because we're going to have the best kind of king. Tonight we're going to be thinking about the United Kingdom, but before we do that, we're going to get going with some reveal to see if we can kind of come up to speed. Some of you haven't been in the first part, and some of you have, and so we're just going to run through a few things. As you look at the Old Testament, what we're trying to do is get the universal of the Old Testament and see how all the particulars, all the little pieces fit into it. So what is the universal of the Old Testament? And I got three options there, but let's just think about them. What's number one?
To God be the glory.
To God be the glory. It's all about the great things He has done. That the universal theme of the Bible and the Old Testament as well is to God be the glory, the glorification of God. I think most of us would probably shake our head and say that's a pretty good theme. And probably in one sense that holds everything together. The reasons it's written for us, when we get it all done and look at all this stuff, we say, you know, great things He's done. We have a great God. To God be the glory. And so some people believe that is the universal that holds together all of the Bible and especially the Old Testament. There's another one. What's number two? Jackie.
Salvation.
Salvation.
History.
The history of redemption. All right. Sometimes called the scarlet thread or the trail of blood or a lot of different terms, and usually under this theme, some people, if you read a lot of commentaries, they will talk about the universal, the glory of God, or the salvation history. And if you look at it that way, what they will say is this, there are some, it's like a cycle going around as you read history from Genesis all the way through. First of all, God will what man? Directs him, gives him instructions. Remember Garden of Eden, here's what I want you to do, here's what you can do, here's what you can't do, on and on it goes. So God will always direct man and give him instruction for living, and then man will
rebel
against God, and so there's sin, and therefore God has to
judge
the sin, or judge man, and bring about punishment, and kick him out of the garden, or whatever it might be, and then man will need salvation, and often they come to the point of crying out to God, or calling out to God, and so there's man's inability, or man's need of salvation, and then God will do what? He'll provide redemption. And you will just see that cycle going around and around and around and around in Scripture. And whether it's Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, whether it's Cain and Abel, whatever it is, there's this thing about God says, here's how I want you to live. Man rebels against it. God has to punish him. Man needs redemption. And God will provide it in one form or another. God is affecting His rule by bringing salvation in the midst of judgment. And as you get all done with the Bible, if you read the Bible with that theme, you would just see that God has always provided salvation in the midst of judgment. And the statement would be, whoever calls the name of the Lord will be saved. And so it's a story of salvation. Right? That would be a good theme for the Bible, a good universal. And a lot of people believe that. And that would be a great way to hold it together. The third way is what? Who's got it? God establishing his rule. Thy kingdom come. All right? And looking at the Bible from that perspective, the thing that holds it all together is God is working through history to establish his rule, to establish his kingdom, which involves salvation and the glory of him and all that other stuff, but is God establishing his kingdom and rule. Here's what then we would say. The ultimate purpose of history, the events of life, is God bringing glory to himself by demonstrating he alone is the sovereign ruler of history and the
salvation
or savior of humanity. And so you kind of cover all three bases there. The glory of God. Bring glory to himself by showing he's the sovereign ruler. I'm a boss. I'm in charge. And I'm the one, the only one who can provide salvation for you. That definition of history, by the way, is from Reynolds Showers, who will be here in April again. And so that's a great, great definition of history, I think. The ultimate purpose of history. And I remember that if you're going to take quizzes in the next few weeks with me. That's a great one. So that's the universal. And you can pick any of the three. It doesn't bother me. I think all of them three kind of come together in that third one. So let's look at the next thing that we need to remember about the Old Testament. What are the divisions of the Old Testament? Anybody want to give the three? Mike, you got them?
History, poetry, and prophecy.
There you go. History, poetry, and prophecy. And we just have the chart there, and you can do it very easily with that. History looks which direction? Looks back. Why do you need history? You can't drive a boat looking back. But it's kind of nice to stand in the back and look back once, right? Right? What do you need history for?
It will guide your future.
All right.
Mistakes of others and the successes of others.
Okay. There's a lot of things for you. If you look to the past, you see, oh, I know why we're here. Look what happened yesterday. You know, you can kind of figure out why you're here. You can, 12 people in history sinned against God, and all of them got punished. I wonder what's going to happen if I sin against God, you know? If you keep looking at history, you can probably learn a lot. That's why it's sometimes an advantage to be a second child instead of a first child. First child just kind of keeps making mistakes. The second child watches his bigger brother or bigger sister and goes, you know, I don't think I'm trying that one, you know? And so history is great. And all those historical things, and that's part of what we're studying tonight, we're still in history, is looking back. We can learn from it. It really gives us direction and helps us to know why we are where we are and what we need to do because of what has happened in the past. How about poetry? Well, let's go to prophecy because that's easier. What's prophecy in your mind? It's always looking to the future. Although much of this prophecy in the Old Testament has already been fulfilled, some of it hasn't, but a lot of it has. When it was written, a lot of it was written in a historical context and it was future for them at that point. So there's a real advantage to knowing the future. And so prophecy is very, very helpful as you look to the future. So poetry, if history's past, prophecy's future, what would poetry be?
The now.
The now, the present. And so when we study poetry in just a few weeks, that's what it's going to be about. Job's through Song of Song. They're kind of like timeless. They're very, very special. And they help you and me to understand how to live today, how to live now, what are some principles, et cetera, et cetera. That's the second part. What are the divisions of the historical section? Well, let's just fill them in quickly. Genesis 1 through 11 is, somebody said it, beginnings. All right? And you have the beginning of life, beginning of the world, beginning of marriage, and on it goes. All right? The beginnings. All right? Genesis 12 through 50 is the
patriarchs,
Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, 12 sons, et cetera, et cetera. The patriarchs. Exodus through Deuteronomy is the birth of a birth of a nation. The nation now is being born. Joshua to Ruth. Conquest. Settlement. And crisis. So Joshua, they are taking the land. There's conquest. And they're supposed to settle it. Judges is partially that. But then they get into crisis. And Judges is all about crisis. And then Ruth is the ultimate crisis in that. So conquest and settlement. With them, crisis going on. Samuel to 1 Kings. The United Kingdom. And that's what we're going to be studying tonight. 1 and 2 Kings, but mainly 2 Kings is divided kingdom. We'll study that next week. 1 and 2 Chronicles is a repeat of all the other stuff. So why is it repeated? Well, it's history with perspective. Just looking at all the history from a different perspective And so it's very, very helpful. And then Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, the last of the historical section is post-exile or post-exilic. All right? That's a little different than perhaps you've studied the seven dispensations, innocence and conscience and government and patriarchs and law and grace and kingdom. And that's another way of dividing up the scriptures if you want it. But we're just looking at the historical section, and that's the way we have broken it up, and that's one way to keep it going. What are some key items? As you go through the Bible, especially the Old Testament, in Genesis 3:15, you suddenly are thrown out with this statement, we're looking for a
seed of the woman.
Seed of the woman. And the reason we're looking for that, because Satan will bruise his heel, but he will
crush
his head. Exactly. So we're thinking, man, if we could only find the seed of the woman, that would be the key to life. We could just have somebody who could crush Satan's head. And remember, Adam and Eve had some kids, and they named the first one Cain as if he was the seed. They thought, maybe he's it. Well, they were disappointed. He wasn't it. And throughout history, there's this looking for the seed of the woman. And, of course, we understand that ultimately that person was
Jesus Christ.
So we were looking for the seed of a woman. Also, in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3, God calls Abraham. And so he says, you're going to be great. And then you're going to have kids.
Many.
Yeah. And then your kid will have kids. And on it goes in a great nation. So we're looking for the seed of Abraham. And the seed of Abraham would be the one through which a great nation would be formed so that all nations could be blessed. So somehow the blessing that all nations need, including us Gentiles, is found through the seed of a woman, is also through the seed of Abraham. There's one that I didn't put there. I should have put there after Genesis 12. 1 Samuel 8 is about where we have brought ourselves and about where we are. They said, we want a king. And God ultimately would bring him a king, and his name would be First Saul, but the second one, the first one in the long line would be
David.
And he said, your seed will be on the throne forever. So we're looking for the seed of a woman, the seed of Abraham, and now we're going to be, and we haven't quite got there in our studies, but we're going to be looking for the seed of David, who would sit on a throne. Another key as you think about the Old Testament is Psalm 78, verse 54, 55 through there. Do you remember what it says there? Israel, Psalm 70 is a great history lesson, all about the history of Israel. And they did this, and they rebelled, and they did this, and they rebelled. Somebody read verse 54. Go ahead, look it up, Jackie. And I think it's verse 54 or verse 57. And as he goes through this whole history of Israel, that's one of my favorite Psalms, 778. But what does it say? I think it's verse 54.
And he brought them to the border of his sanctuary, even to this mountain which his right hand had purchased.
Well, you got to keep going.
He cast out the heathen also before them and divided them an inheritance by line and made the tribes of Israel to dwell in their tents.
Keep going through 57. It's the last words of 57.
Yet they tempted and provoked the Most High God and kept not his testimony, but turned back and dealt unfaithfully like their fathers. They were turned aside like a deceitful host.
All right. So you have this great history lesson. And as you look at it, he does this for them, and yet they rebel, and he does this for them, and on and on it goes. And finally, he says, here's the key. Here's the problem. They tested and provoked the Most High, wouldn't keep his testimonies. They always were turning back, unfaithful like their fathers. You know why? They were a deceitful bull. So somebody explain that. I think we've explained it in the class. What's a deceitful bull? Anybody bull hunting around here? Mike, do you go hunting?
No.
Okay. What's a deceitful bull?
It's a bull that looks okay, but it shoot straight so you can't hit on target.
Exactly right. There's something in the very warp and woof of the material. We should have George DeLoff here who makes his own bows, you know. You know, it looks great. You pull it back, and for some reason, it just won't, it's twisted somewhere. And he will tell you how tough it is to find the right wood, get the right grain, and how much skill you need. I mean, a guy like me, I'd look at a tree, I wouldn't know that. He can look at a piece of wood and say, you know, that one, I think if I cut it right here, I can get a straight bow. And he said, it's in the very character of the bow. It cannot shoot straight. And that's the way Israel was. It's in the very character of the Jewish people. And surprise, it's kind of in the character of all people. We're like a deceitful bow. It's in the warp and woof of who we are. And God understands that. So in one sense, it explains it. Also, it gives us a little hope. God does know that we're all sinners. And by nature, we're sinners. And without His grace and without His work in our life, that's the way we would be. So those are some key items. Now, remember in 1 Samuel 8 is where we kind of ended up last time. And they wanted a king. And we studied. So let's just do a little bit of review on that. What was true about the pre-king Israel? No strong central government. Wouldn't that be cool? No capital. No taxes. No army. No Supreme Court. No nothing. Hey, bring me to your king. We don't have one. Bring me to your capital. We don't have one. How much taxes do you pay? We don't. I mean, how can you survive without a king, you know? Well, Israel really would have done well because they had a king ultimately. His name was God. And he worked through judges and priests and a lot of other people throughout time. But there was no strong central government. The priests, what was their job? What's the job of a priest?
Offer sacrifices.
Offer sacrifices, and they did more than that, didn't they?
Establish the rule of God.
Okay, establish the rule of God by offering sacrifices and
teaching.
All right? And why do you need both of those? Why do you need somebody to, I'm going to establish the rule of God in your life. We better have sacrifices for you. But we also want to teach you. Why do you need the two? What's the sacrifices for? Yeah. We already know you blew it. And you're going to blow it. You're going to keep blowing it. So we need to have some system that takes care of your sin in your life. That somehow allows you to get back on track. And so sacrifices, obviously, again, didn't take care of sin, but they pointed to the one who would. And so the priests were the ones who were establishing God's rule by, first of all, taking care of your sin problem, the sin that you committed. And why do you need teaching? What's the value? Yeah, hopefully, by teaching, we can tell you what God wants you to do, what's right and what's wrong, and eventually, you should improve. You'll never be perfect, and you always need sacrifices. There'll always be the Day of Atonement, but by teaching, you'll know right from wrong, and you will start to live more and more godly and righteously. So the priests, that was their job, to establish God's rule by sacrifices for sins and teaching of what is right for living. Now the judges, there's another group. What was their, the Shofim, as they were called, what was their job? To establish God's heavenly pattern, all right? By, here's what a judge did. Even to this day, you can think of a judge. What's a judge do? He decides things, right? I mean, it's what a judge does. So judicially, these judges would make decisions about right and wrong, and this is right and whatever. Politically, the judges, like Gideon and Samson and whoever, what did they do? There were enemies that had come in, and they would be used of God to drive the enemies out so that the nation could be free. So they had a judicial role, they had a political role, but they also had a spiritual role. And their spiritual role was to establish God's heavenly pattern in the lives of people so that people would live right. And so they weren't just, you know, we're going to kill the Amalekites and we're going to wipe out the Philistines and whatever. So they had a role. Yet, what was true about the priests by the time that they were saying, give us a new king, or give us a king?
They were corrupt.
They were corrupt. They were laying with the women at the gates of the temple. I mean, you can't get much worse than that, it doesn't seem. So they were moral failures and derelict in their duty. And you can read about that not only in 1 Samuel, but you can read about it especially in Judges 17 and 18. It was a tremendous statement there. The judges, what had happened to them? Well, Gideon, in the middle of it, he was not confident in God's power. God says, all right, you mighty man of valor, let's go get him. And he goes, who, me? He didn't trust God at all, but God eventually used him. And so Gideon is not able to have confidence in God's power, at least not initially, ultimately he does. And then there's one named Samson at the end. He was not able to establish God's pattern even in his own life. So he's supposed to be establishing God's pattern in the lives of people. So at the end of the book of Judges, it says there's no king in Israel. In other words, there's no ruler. Wouldn't that be great? You're free. You can do anything you want. No rules, man. Just imagine your kids growing up. Just say, no rules. You can eat anytime you want. You can sleep anytime you want. You can go to school if you want. You can stay home if you want. You can play outside. You can stay inside. No rules, man. Wonderful. Life would be great. Going to work and no boss. You can do whatever you want today. Show up when you want. Work as hard as you want. Make as many tractors as you want or not. Wouldn't it be great? There was no king in Israel. They had no ruler. And everybody, therefore, did what was right in his own eyes. There was no righteousness. And so at the end of Judges, there's a mess. And really what it's saying is, you guys are not able to run on your own. You're like little kids. If you let them run, they'll eat the wrong food, go to bed at the wrong time. They'll kill each other eventually. I mean, it doesn't work. They need parents so that they don't do what's right in their own eyes, because they're not capable of handling it on their own. And so that's the message ultimately Judges. So that's what we have come to. They need a king. All right. By the way, as you go through the, we talked about this a little bit, you know, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, but that failed, and then, you know, Patriarchs fails and whatever. Why does God keep letting things fail? Why did he give them judges and that didn't work? Why did he give them priests? Why didn't he give them a king right away?
It's man who failed, God didn't fail.
Okay. And God would have known that, though. So why didn't he right from the start give us Christ as a millennial king? Why do we have to wait all these years of history till we finally get Christ as millennial king? Because then it's going to be great for us. It'll be bad for some other people, but it's going to be great for us. Why didn't you just start with that? Yeah, you actually have to ask the question, what if he had? How would it be different? Well, we would have never known. See, we think, if you put me in a perfect environment where I have everything I need, life is good, and I walk and talk with God, I'd never sin. Would you?
It's inherent in man
exactly.
To do evil.
So we had to learn that from the Garden of Eden.
Right.
All right? Even if you were in a perfect environment with walking and talking with God, with all the things you need, you could eat the bounty of the land, guess what you'd do? You'd still sin. Then you have patriarchs. What if you had fathers running the show? Now that would work. No, it didn't work. By the time of Judah, father is doing bad, and his kids are even worse. Just read Genesis 37, 38, somewhere in there. Judah is a bad father, and fathers are bad. And as you go through it, Judges, great system, except it doesn't work. Priests, great system, just doesn't work. So he has to keep doing that. So now we're ready to go to Kings. Two more things here. Who are the three transitional figures, and what are the three results of unconstrained sin? By the end of Judges, I mean, it's a mess. Everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes. There's no standards. There's no sovereign. It's a mess. So you have three transitional figures. Their names are Ruth, Eli, and Samuel. What does Ruth teach us? The first result of unrestrained sin is we will run. So in that story, they take off. The family takes off from Bethlehem, and they go to Moab. We're just getting out of here, man. This is not working. So we'll go to another land with another people. And God says, well, that doesn't work really either, you know. And all the men die, so they finally have to come back. Running is not the answer. Running is really not the answer. So then you have Eli. What do you learn from Eli? We will reap. He shows us as a person what was actually happening as a nation in a broader perspective. They're reaping what they have sown. They have so many advantages. Eli had so many advantages, and yet his boys are terrible. They are morally, spiritually, and ultimately politically reaping what they've sown. Remember at the end, Eli, how does he die? He's an old man, falls off his. Yeah. And why did he fall off, and why did he break his neck?
Because he heard the shocking news that Israel had lost the
blessing. Yeah. They had lost politically. His sons had taken off with the Ark of the Covenant. His sons were both killed in battle. The Ark of the Covenant's gone. Eli goes, falls over. A little baby's born, by the way. His name was Ichabod. The glory's gone. You reap what you sow. That's what you learn from Eli. And then you learn from Samuel in his day. We thought, Samuel's here. He's a judge and a priest. And he starts out so well. I mean, this kid heard God and did all kinds of good things. But guess what happened with his boys? They're worse than Eli's boys. And so the people of Israel say, we want a king. We will request. We say, first of all, I'm going to run. And Ruth, the message of Ruth is, that doesn't work. We will reap what we sow. We will request. We'll ask for a king. What's wrong with the request of the people? Some people think it was wrong to have a king. That's not the problem. Because God predicted a king would come. Ultimately, we will have a king. His name is Jesus Christ, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That's not the problem. What's the problem with their request? They wanted a system that replaced God. We want a system like other nations. Separation of church and state here. You know, we need a system where there's no God present. We want a king to rule us, not the king that really was found in God. It was a system that ultimately rejected God. Remember when Samuel was brokenhearted, God says, don't cry. They didn't reject you, they rejected me. And ultimately, Samuel would say to the people, you guys really want this? It's a system that removed God's benefits. Now he said, you're going to have taxes. You're going to have drafting of your young men and your young women for service and military and whatever. You have oppression, and on the list goes. Remember Alexis de Tocqueville? Democracy in America, when he was asked, I wish we would hear about him more often. You never hear about him in the political campaigns. He was asked, and he came to America, the Frenchman came to America in the early 1800s, and just evaluated why we were so successful. How could a bunch of bumpkins in the middle of a country like this survive and make it and thrive and beat the British and do well? And he looked at our natural resources. Boy, they got more natural resources than anybody else. I mean, it's great, you know. And he looked at, you know, water power to run factories. And I mean, we had everything. But at the end, he said, it is not their government. It is not their natural resources. And it is not their intelligence and the whole bunch. It is their mores. It's their morals. It is their morals. And hopefully we learn that from Judges. And so we want a king.
I wonder what he'd say today.
Yeah. We need change. It seems to be a very popular word today. And if we got to change the system, we got to change who's in charge. And if we can change who's in charge and change the system, you know, everything will be perfect. Surprise. You know, until we change hearts, you know, it's the morals. In fact, George Washington said the same thing. I wish I had his quote. And it went something like this. He said, the day that we as a nation forget about God is the day we will decline. It is not our natural resources. It is not our form of government. It is not democracy. It is not whatever that makes us great. It's that we are a moral people. And guys go to work and they give them a full day's work. My son just called from South America. He drove from La Paz, Bolivia, down to Iguazu Falls in Argentina. He had to cross through Paraguay and Brazil. So when he left Bolivia, went into Paraguay, you're just driving down the road and you didn't even know you went into the land. There's no border guards, there's no nothing. So they were just driving along, and next thing you know, they were in Paraguay. So he didn't get his visa stamped or his passport stamped because there's no place to stop, you know. So he goes all the way through Paraguay, a two-day drive, and he gets to leaving it. And he should have just drove on because there was nobody there. But he went to a police station just to check out. And the guy said, oh, you got to go all the way back and get an entry visa. And Jason said, can't do that. It's a two-day drive. He said, but we got a way you can get out of it. $100. You know, the whole system's corrupt. When we lose right and wrong, moral integrity, and the system goes corrupt, we'll be a mess. And so that's what we learned there. So they're looking for a king. Any comments? We're ready to go. United Kingdom. Thoughts? I don't mean to dominate all the time. Feel free to talk. Well, they're going to give Manuel's system a chance. We want a king. It was just so, it really struck us as pastors because he was talking about elections and so he says, I really miss the king. He really missed his king.
Do you know, I read an article in Newsweek, the Islamic nations are trying to reform the caliphate.
Really? Wow.
They said that is the best form of government for all Muslims.
As long as you get a good king, it's a great system. You get the wrong king and it's the worst system. I personally like democracy, but anyway, if we had the right king, it would be a wonderful, wonderful system. All right. First of all, we have to go to Deuteronomy chapter 17 and review a little bit there about kings. Because some people think that in 1 Samuel chapter 8, when we start with the kings, that it's like God never thought of this one, you know. God surely doesn't want kings. Well, God is not against kings. From this point on, there will be a king of David sitting on a throne. So it's really not that. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, we have Moses speaking, of course. And in verse 14 down through verse 20, he will say these words. When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around you. God knew this was going to happen. Someday you're going to want that system. You shall surely set a king over you, whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as a king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. So the first requirement is, if you, when you get to that point and you really want a king, make sure that you don't choose him. Make sure God chooses him. So the king, to be successful, has to be chosen by God. That should teach us a lot, by the way. We're not very good at choosing. All right? We really aren't. As smart as we think we are not good at choosing. We better let God choose him. At least that's what he said there. Number two, verse 16. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall you multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. So don't multiply horses, don't multiply wives, and don't multiply material wealth, gold and silver. What's wrong with that stuff? Well, if you're the king, what's horses all about?
Power.
Power, military might. I mean, that's like tanks. That's like cutting-edge aircraft, whatever. I mean, in those days, that was military power. What's wrong with that? Why do you say, I don't want you to be like the other nations? They have a lot of horses and chariots and whatever. I don't want you to do that.
So don't depend on God.
You depend on me, he said. All right? So don't multiply horses. Trust me. Depend upon me. The same thing with wives. It's not that wives were so much for a physical relationship, but they were all political alliances. So you made a treaty with a nation, and they gave you one of the king's daughters. And when it said Solomon had 300 wives and 700 concubines, he probably never knew most of them. Never even knew what they looked like. But he had that many alliances with all those nations. So he was not only relying on horses, he was relying on political arrangements. All right? God said, you don't need political arrangements. Don't trust those guys. You trust me. And finally, don't trust gold and silver. If we get enough money, we can buy our way out of anything, you know? So he has to be chosen by God. He has to be dependent upon God. In other words, God has to enable him to accomplish whatever needs to be done. And God can enable him. God can gift him. So the success is dependent on, has to be chosen by God, has to be dependent or enabled by God. And finally, verse 18, and shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and those statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren, in order that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. So what's that all about? Why does he have to write it with his own hand, all the law? How many of you have ever written the Bible? I haven't. Have you ever read the whole Bible? Probably. You know. I mean, just imagine if tomorrow next week my assignment to you was, I want you to write out by hand every word from 2 Kings. You'd all leave and never come back, right? He says, kings, they got to write them out. What good is writing your notes? It makes it very personal. You write it out and you got it. You remember it. You remember a certain percentage of what you hear, you remember a greater percentage of what you hear and write. Okay, so that's one of the things. Write it out, but here's why. That he may learn to fear the Lord and be careful to observe it, keep his commandments, all right? So the third requirement of a king is chosen, dependent, and obedient. You better know the law, buddy. You better have it personally in your life. You better fear me and obey me and do what I tell you to do. And then everything will be fine. So that's what we're going to look at. Now we're just going to look at the United Kingdom. It's from 1040 to 920 B.C. And those dates are plus or minus a year or two. But pretty much most people agree with those dates quite well. The first king, of course, was who? Saul. And we're going to call him the people's choice. It's 1 Samuel chapter 9 through through the end of 1 Samuel. Pretty much 1 Samuel is about Saul. David is going to be rising in that, but he's not king. 2 Samuel is David. 1 Kings is Solomon. That's kind of the way it's going to be. The people's choice would not, according to Samuel, as he predicted in chapter 8, verse 10 through 18, the people's choice would not bring satisfaction. You think it's going to be great, but he's going to oppress you, draft, tax, bureaucracy. I mean, it's going to not be good. But the real question is, people say, okay, I'll live with that. I'll live with taxes and drafts and bureaucracy and all that nonsense. I'll live with all that as long as we have security and success and life is good. Okay? I don't know if you've talked to people in other lands. I have a daughter and son-in-law who live in Canada. Their taxes are very high compared to ours. And my son-in-law, who's lived in Canada his whole life, I said, why don't you move to America, man? It's scary to him. He says, you don't have national health care. He says, you don't have a government that takes care of you from womb to tomb. And so he's satisfied with paying 50% tax or whatever it is. It's probably more than that. He's satisfied to pay that because of what he thinks he's getting, security and whatever. So people are willing to pay that price as long as it's success. I'm secure. So we got to look at this and say, is that what's going to happen with this whole new system? 1 Samuel 9, was he chosen? Well, let's just read verse 17. 1 Samuel, I'm in 1 Chronicles, that's no good. Somebody read 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 17, if you would.
And when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said unto him, behold, the man whom I spake to thee up, the same shall reign over my people.
All right. And if you read 1 Samuel 9, most of the chapter there, you would find that through a whole bunch of bizarre things, some dumb donkeys get lost in, you know, the whole story. And Saul is sent up there to find him and can't find him. And donkey's already back home. And he goes into a city because somebody said there's a prophet there. His name is Samuel. And Samuel shows up. And that's where it says, you know, tomorrow morning this guy's going to walk up looking for some donkeys. And you just, you're going to know that's the one who's going to reign over it. And it's shown to Samuel, This is the one I want to be the king. So it's his choice is very clear. It was shown or stated to Samuel in chapter 10, verse 24. Somebody read that one. If you went through the accounts, you know, Samuel's got it. Saul's going to say, oh, not me. And he's very humble about the whole deal. He's like, I'm just a normal guy here. Why are you making me king, you know? But eventually, in verse 24 of chapter 10, it says, anybody?
Samuel said to all the people, do you see the man the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people. Then the people shouted, long live the king.
All right, so Samuel presents it to the people, and the majority of people there, if you read verse 17 of chapter 10, he called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah, and there he presents Saul, and the people said, long live the king. They've accepted him. But if you read chapter 10, 11, there's a group of skeptics, and they say, I don't think so. And so chapter 11 is all about the Spirit of God came upon Saul, and when the Ammonites attacked, Saul, just the Spirit of God takes him, and he says to all the children of Israel, the 30,000 from Judah and the 300,000 from Israel, let's go get them. And the Spirit of God just so empowers him, he leads the people, and they go to battle, and they defeat the Ammonites. And when it's all done, in verse 15 of chapter 11, and all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made King Saul before the Lord in Gilgal. There they made sacrifices of peace before the Lord, and there saw and all the men of Israel greatly rejoiced. And so he is anointed, or he is appointed by God and chosen by God. It is shown to Samuel, is clearly chosen by God in chapter 10, verse 24, and he's accepted by the people in chapter 11, verse 15. I think everybody, if you took the time to read those chapters, you would have to conclude God made it clear to Samuel and to Saul and to the people, this is my choice. So he's chosen. He's got the first of the three things. God chose him, people didn't. Now, he's not only chosen, he's gifted. He's got ability. We'll just quickly run down them, and we won't read all of these. You know his life if you've read it. He has a great heritage. He's of the tribe of Benjamin, and on it goes. And even though eventually it's going to be from the tribe of Judah, the kings will come tribe of Benjamin's great, great heritage. Remember Saul, who became Paul in the New Testament, said, you know, I'm a Hebrew of the Hebrews, I was a tribe of Benjamin, you know. That was kind of like the upper echelon, man. That was top of the line. He came from the right heritage. Chapter 9, verse 1, would talk about he was a mighty man of power. He had great power. Chapter 9, verse 2, he was handsome. In fact, he was head and shoulders taller than anybody. I mean, this guy was a brute, and he was handsome, and, I mean, he was good. Chapter 9, verse 17, when Samuel saw, the Lord said to him, there he is, the man of whom I spoke to you. He shall reign over my people. He is a man who is directed by God. As you read through that account, he responds to God. Chapter 10, verses 1 through 9, he's anointed by God. We don't have time to read these, but clearly God has anointed him, and the Spirit of God is going to come upon him in chapter 10 and verse 10. So, I mean, he really has been enabled to do the task. He is led by the Spirit in chapter 10, verse 10. He is gifted in chapter 10, verse 11. You could read about that. He prophesies and does some things that normal people don't do. He is, in chapter 10, verse 22, he's very modest. He had hit among the equipment. You know, they all want to make him king, and he's like, no, not me. I don't need that. Just don't put me on a pedestal. I just want to be a normal king or whatever. He's very modest. In fact, chapter 10, verse 24, they say, long live the king. And yet, if you read through verse 25, 26, 27, he just lived like a normal person. He didn't take on the airs of a king with a great big palace and all that. He was very modest, very simple. In chapter 10, verse 27, the rebels said, how can this man save us? I mean, he should have just whipped those guys and wiped them out, but he's self-controlled. I mean, everything about him would tell you he is very capable of doing this job. His natural characteristics, height, handsomeness, heritage, all that, his supernatural characteristics, Spirit of God directing, Spirit of God controlling, on and it goes. And so in chapter 10, verse 24, they say, long live the king. God gave them the king of their dreams. If you and I were ever going to choose somebody to say, you know, we've got to fight enemies and whatever, who do you want to pick? Saul's the man. Good heritage. Handsome, tall, led by the Spirit of God, prophesied. I mean, he would be the man. Yet, in that context, in chapter 12 and verse 14, God wants to remind them, I have chosen him and I have gifted him. Both natural and supernatural ways God used to prepare this man for this task. And yet in chapter 12 and verse 14, it says this, I want to remind you though, guys, if you fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against his commandments, then both you and the king who reigns over you will continue following the Lord your God. At the end of the day, we still got to obey, right? Got to fear, we got to serve, we got to obey. The king has to do it. You have to do it. That's going to be the key. So he's chosen. And he's gifted. He's enabled. His ability is there. So our question is, how's his obedience? And of course, we know the account, but if we had not known the account before we came tonight, we'd never read this before, we'd just say, I wonder how he's going to do. God chose him. God enabled him. He seems to be modest. In chapter 11, he's very valiant. He leads the army, 330,000 men from Israel and Judah, destroys the Ammonites. I mean, this guy is good. So what do you remember from chapter 13, 14, and 15 of 1 Samuel? As immediately after God has said in chapter 12, now you guys remember, fear me, serve me, obey me. What happened in chapter 13? Anybody remember that? Let's read a little bit about it. He reigned 1 year. Then he reigned 2 years over Israel. Verse 1. Chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel. On and on it goes. And you have this Philistine attack in verse 3. He blows the trumpet. All Israel heard it. That the Philistines are coming. And we've got to take care of the Philistines. All right? As you drop down through this account, you remember when the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, and the people hid in caves and thickets and rocks and holes and pits. Verse 8, he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. You know, you can't go take them on until you get Samuel's word from the Lord for you, Saul. Okay? So he's got his whole army scared to death in thickets and caves and whatever. 7 days is what Samuel said it would be. It's been 7 days. You're not here, Samuel. So what did he do? He sacrificed on his own, didn't he? He was supposed to wait. But sometimes you just can't wait for God. I mean, you got to admit that. God said 7 days. It was 7 days. And my men are scared and they're in caves and thickets and the Philistines are coming. And, you know, we can't wait. And so he sacrifices on his own. In verse 9, bring me a burnt offering and peace offering here. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened. I love that phrase, don't you? Now it happened. Scripture is full of that little phrase. It's just saying, all right, I want you to know that every event of history that looks like it just happened is right on time. There's a God who's directing everything that just happened. Now it just happened. As soon as he had done with that, that Samuel came. Now isn't that something? Same day Samuel said he'd be there, he was there. It was just a few minutes later than what Saul thought it should be. And so here is Saul. In chapter 13, we have the battle with the Philistines. He's impatient. I can't trust God's timing. You know, God says 7 days, he'll be here. You know, it's getting noon, it's getting 1 o'clock. I'm not sure we can handle this much longer. I'll go do the sacrifice. And he disobeys. And you remember what happened when Samuel confronts him? Defends it. I have a great reason for doing this. I mean, it's logical, it's rational, it's the right thing to do. I know kings aren't supposed to offer burnt offerings and sacrifices, and I know you were supposed to. I was supposed to wait for you, but I still did the right thing, and he defends it. So what does God do? Verse 14.
Takes the dynasty away from him.
Exactly. Verse 14, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be the commander over his people, because you have not kept for the Lord. You can stay king for a while, Saul, but your kids aren't going to be kings, and so the dynasty is going to end. It's going to end with you. But you can live, and you can keep being king, but it's going to end. So he's deprived of his dynasty, and that's chapter 13. In a sense, you could actually have three events here. In chapter 14, remember, the Philistines is still the Philistine thing. And Jonathan, who is a tremendous guy, it seems like. He's got a few flaws, but I mean, he just seems to be a tremendous guy. He's out there, and he takes on the Philistines, and he beats them, you know. Several times he's done that in the records of here. And remember, he climbed that cliff, and they weren't expecting them. He comes over the top. And they have to take him on, so they're taking him on. There's 20 guys up there. He takes them all on, kills them all off. But in the midst of all that, there's a rout that goes on. The Philistines start to worry about things and start to run. So the Israelites figure out, hey, the Philistines are running. We got to do something. So Saul, he's the king. You know, he's kind of like, I got to be in charge of this. And so he rashly makes a statement. Anybody, we're going to go get those Philistines today. And you can't sleep, and you can't eat, and you can't take in honey or anything like that. And if you do, I'm going to kill you. And what did Jonathan do? Oh, he hadn't heard it. And he'd been up there fighting. He was hungry. Came across some honey, took some honey. And he violated his dad's rash thing. And remember in chapter 14, when Saul found out, he said, you will surely die. And the men had to pull Saul off from killing his own son. So he's impatient in chapter 13. He's impetuous in chapter 14. I mean, the guy is crazy. I mean, I don't need a king like this. You did so well in chapter 10. You did so well in chapter 11, chapter 12, chapter 13. What are you doing sacrificing? Chapter 14, what are you doing going to kill your own son? So he's impetuous. He can't trust God's way of dealing it. He has to make rash oaths. It's like magic. It's like, if I really promise everybody that, you know, make it rough on them, we're not going to eat anything, then surely God will bless us. It's like, that's not why God blesses you. Now, chapter 15. There is the battle with the Ammonites. It's a little bit later. And you suddenly see he does another thing. God says to him, now you go out and kill the, in verse 3, Amalekites. Not the Ammonites, but the Amalekites. Utterly destroy them. Don't spare them. Kill everything. Man and women. Child. Ox. Sheep. Camel. Donkey. You do it all. So how do you do on this one? Oh, man, it's tough to follow God when you got free slaves. All these oxen. I mean, why would you kill the oxen, the donkeys, and the camels? I mean, logic that one out for me. So he kind of keeps a few things, as you remember. And then it just happens. Who shows up? Samuel shows up. Boy, don't you hate Samuel? He keeps showing up at all the wrong times. He goes, how'd it go? Oh, it went great. Did you obey God? Absolutely. You know, what is that bleeding I hear in my ears, you know? And you know what? In verse 13 of chapter 15, Saul lies. I have performed the commandment of the Lord at the end of verse 13. He just straight out lies. When he says, oh, I think I hear some bleeding and lowing or something, then he rationalizes in verse 15. Well, you know, they have brought them from the Amalekites, and the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen because we want to give it to you, Lord, as sacrifice. And, you know, this was a really good thing what we did, even though it's disobedience. And then finally, in verse 20, Saul says to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, the king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites, but the people. It's blame shifting. I did everything right, but you can't control all your people, you know. It's not my fault. And I'm not going. So he disobeys, and then he really is deceiving. The whole thing is deception. The first time he defends his actions, now he deceives. He's trying to pull the wool over Samuel, like Samuel wouldn't figure this one out. And therefore God says to him, I'm sorry. I'm going to deprive you not of the dynasty. Your kids aren't going to be king. I'm going to deprive you of the throne. You're going to die. So how did it end? Chapter 16 through 31. Well, chapter 16 through 27, you just see a decline. And near the end of that verse, in fact, in chapter 28, verse 9, he can't even find any guidance from God anymore. So he has to go to the witch of Endor. I mean, this guy is in a free fall, all decline. And then in chapter 28 through 31, it's his death. It's like a Greek tragedy where the hero has so much going for him, but he has this character flaw. In Saul's case, he's disobedient. And God says, I'm sorry, you're going to go downhill. And he spirals down, commits suicide at the end. It's the hero desperately trying to hold on to his power, yet all the time marching to his death. Remember, now it's David in those chapters is rising, you know, the Goliath thing and all that stuff. And he's trying to kill off David. I mean, he's trying to hold on to his power, but he's dying. What went wrong with the people's choice?
He didn't trust and obey.
Yeah, he just had one little problem. He was surely chosen, and he was surely capable and able, but he wouldn't obey. So what do you learn? Then we'll take a break. Don't look at my notes. What'd you learn? The people's choice. We want a king. New system. Let us pick him. You know.
People's choice will always fail.
Yeah, okay.
We look on the outward appearance and don't look at the
heart. Okay, good. Which is exactly what we're going to find. In fact, it's stated there. We didn't read it about David. Yeah. What else you learn?
Rushing into something that is necessarily wrong can be wrong for you in the end.
Okay, good. Excellent. Anything else you learn? Those are great. 1 Samuel 8:18, you will cry for a king, and then you will cry because of your king. The people's choice isn't always right. By the way, you got to ask the question, why does he give him the one named Saul? Why does he start with David? And I think if you read chapter 12, verse 24, and in chapter 14, verse 47, really what he did, God knew this is the guy you would have chosen, so I'm going to give it to him. Give him to you. In fact, I'm going to put the Spirit of God in him, so he's got a lot of advantages. I'm going to give you your dream king. I'm going to give it to you. Why? Because they had to learn your dream king can fail you. The one you would choose isn't going to make it. And so God often lets us have what we think we need or want. That's not usually good, but He often lets us have that until we learn. That's really not what you wanted. By the way, do you ever do that with your kids? They want, gotta have it, Dad. You say, no, you don't really want that. Yeah, Dad. I remember our youngest Bradley, we were on vacation. We were someplace and they had big pickles in a jar. You know, like 50 cents or a dollar, whatever they were, you know. It's like, Bradley, you don't want a pickle. Yeah, Dad. Now, for some reason, that pickle looked like, you know, candy to him. I got to have a pickle, Dad. You don't want it, Bradley. Yeah, Dad, I got to have a pickle, you know. Okay, if you got money for vacation, if you want to buy the pickle. So you, of course, bought the pickle, and guess what? First bite, Dad, you want the rest of the pickle, you know. He didn't want the pickle. God sometimes lets us have what we want so that we learn. Next time, why don't you trust me? Why don't you trust me to pick out whether you want a pickle or not? So that might be one thing. Another thing I think we learned is Proverbs 14:34, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any nation. I think that we learn a new system didn't bring success. They wanted a king like other nations. If we only have a king like other nations, everything will go right, great. No, it's not the system. You know what exalts a nation? It's righteousness. That's what exalts a nation. That's what makes great nations. And so it's, in one sense, it's not, you know, the right person, other than if that right person can really help us establish righteousness. That's what counts. And so they got the people's choice. Any comments? We'll take a little break.